game.
He's covering himself in case he makes a mistake.
I know, but yeah. He doesn't have to make mistakes for me.
No, it's not you. Gets called up.
I'm totally covered with mistakes.
Yeah, that's great.
So there are a lot of parallels of language, and there's themes, and sometimes there's complete sentences from the Book of Exodus in the Gospels, and that is just a lot of fun. And I think that Mark may have more than his fair share of these connections. So I'm going to spend more time in Mark. But I thought I would start off with something kind of fun. This is a Passover theme, all right? This is Passover week and resurrection day tomorrow, Easter. So I thought I would do a little, maybe a trivia thing for you. So I brought a few questions, and sometimes I actually, if I have time with my tour groups, we play this little game called the Exodus game. And it's just trivia, and we make a map of Egypt, the Sinai, the wilderness, and, you know, divide into teams, and you roll dice to see how far you can get if you get the question right. Yeah, it's a whole deal, and there's like manna bonanza points and everything. Yeah.
Thought we were friends.
Not kidding. Manna bonanza, collect for the Sabbath and move ahead two spaces. So it's really... So here's one of the questions I thought you might find this interesting, and this actually has a... I'm going somewhere with this subject. How much time did Moses have to cut out the second set of stone tablets? You know, the first set was broken.
40 days.
Got some votes for 40 days. Anybody for more or less?
Did Moses do it or God do it?
Well, Moses was told to cut out the second set. And he's given a certain amount of time.
Okay, we're stumped.
It's all right, I wouldn't know this if somebody asked me point blank. This represents the Sinai, okay? And this represents the Mediterranean, just in case you're wondering. Moses is given less than 24 hours.
Oh.
24 hours or less, where God basically tells him, meet me in the morning up on the mount. So he's got less than 24 hours to cut out new stones. All right?
Where's that?
That's in Exodus 34, starting in verses 1 and 2. Which is part
so
of our...
That the time you spend with God was 40 days.
Right.
That's different.
Yeah.
This is cutting out the second set. All right? Now, you may think this is just a very minor thing, but I think it's a major thing. Almost the entire Sinai, starting from about right here, all the key areas of the Sinai... This is all granite. Really hard. In fact, some of the granite extends on up into, you know, points north of Eilat. And I think there's a little bit on the eastern side down in Saudi Arabia, but I think most of the mountains over here are limestone, and most of the mountains here are sandstone and then limestone. I have geological maps.
So the whole Sinai was a volcanic area.
Most of the Sinai is, you know, metamorphic rock, harder. You just don't cut out stone tablets from granite with bronze tools because it's pre-1250 BC, so the tools are going to be cheaper, bronze. Or stone, because it sounds like the Israelites have some rather crude tools with them as well. So I'm pushing...
Or would they?
Or would they?
Because they've been working stone for
either
a
way,
long time.
They're still pre-1250 BC, yeah. So it's still pre-harder, better iron tools. So bronze tools normally aren't used to chisel out harder rock. Yeah, limestone, maybe some softer, you know, but not you know, volcanic rock, not
or flint,
basalt stone. Flint. Yeah, flint tools, maybe. So anyway, I tend to push... I push that whole business up further towards the central Negev highlands, which has a lot more limestone, a lot more sandstone. And I don't really care where Mount Sinai is. I don't have an axe to grind. I don't own any property down there. I'm not trying to open up a business. But I thought we'd just start off with a fun little question like that. All right. Exodus 34, verses 1 and 2, which is part of our weekly... Parashah this week. Okay, let's start with the book of Mark. If you want to just keep Mark open, we're going to start right in chapter 1. And we're going to work our way down. We'll see how far we get. I'm probably going to stop at about 10:35 because I've got to go help play music. But one of the first quotes that we have in Mark, right at the beginning, he says, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who shall prepare your way." And you've all read this probably dozens of times. It's the assumed quote from Malachi 3:1. No matter what your main text says, there's usually a footnote that says, assumed quote is Malachi 3:1, which reads, "Behold, I send my messenger to make a way before me." So why does Mark start out this way, prepare a way before you? So we think, well, maybe it really is Isaiah, but Isaiah also is preparing a way before you, me, in the wilderness, Isaiah 40. So we're kind of, right at the very beginning of Mark, we're a little bit stumped. What's he quoting? What verse is that? We think it's Isaiah, we think maybe Malachi, but neither one of those fits very well. And Luke 7:27 and Matthew 11:10, they all say the same thing. They have the same quote. Well, I was just thumbing through the book of Exodus one evening, and I saw this verse, Exodus 23:20. Where it says, "Behold, I am sending a messenger before you to guard your way and to bring you to the place I have prepared." So it just kind of seemed interesting. Like, well, there's a verse where God is saying, I'm going to prepare your way. And that sounds like how Mark starts out. So I just thought, well, that's interesting. I'll put that on the shelf. Let's move on down to Mark. So you're going to have one finger in Mark and you're going to have one finger in Exodus for the next 35 minutes. Mark chapter 1, verse... Let's just skip right on down to verse 12. Before that, Jesus has been baptized by John in the Jordan. He comes up out of the water. He sees the heavens open. The Spirit descends upon him like a dove, and a voice comes from heaven. And then we have, in verse 12, "The Spirit immediately led him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan, and he was with wild beasts." Verse 13. Do you all see that?
Mm-hmm.
If I went over to the book of Exodus, starting in chapter 1, I have some interesting thoughts here. You know, that Hebrew baby boys are thrown into the Nile River. Yeah. Moses is drawn out of the water. That's kind of interesting. Jesus is coming out of the water. Moses is drawn out of the water. And then If I read in Exodus 3, verse 2, the angel of God appears in a burning bush and God speaks to Moses. In verse 12, he says, I will be with you. And Exodus 4, 22, he says, Israel is my firstborn son. I just find that very interesting. It's the same kind of language that we see in the Gospels. All the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. But when I got down here to Mark 1, 12 and 13, I saw parallels in Exodus with Moses in a slightly different way. I'm sorry if this is going a little too fast, but in Exodus 2:11 and 4:18, you know what? I'll leave these notes if anybody's interested. You can copy this. Because I've got it in a pericope form, so I'm looking at all of them at the same time here. Moses flees to the deserts of Midian and remains there some 40 years. There's no mention of fasting, at least in that part. And later on, actually, God promises to drive the enemies out of the land slowly, otherwise the land would become desolate and wild beasts would be too numerous. So I've got only Mark mentions wild beasts in the wilderness. The other synoptic gospels, and John doesn't mention it. And then I got this interesting thing in Exodus. So now I'm locked in. I'm thinking, wow, I wonder what else, what other parallels there might be in this. So I'm thinking about it. Let's go back to Mark chapter 1, verse 14. It says that Jesus begins to preach the gospel of God, saying, the kingdom of God draws near. And then in verse 16, well, let me just pause that. In Exodus 7, verse 1, it says that Moses will be like God to Pharaoh. So that's kind of a hinge statement. So Jesus is preaching the gospel of the kingdom of heaven, and then Moses is told he's going to be like God to Pharaoh. It's kind of interesting. Let's go back to Mark 1, verse 24. You know that right after the 40 days in the wilderness, Mark has Jesus going straight to the Galilee and straight to Capernaum. And in the first Sabbath that comes, he is straight into the synagogue and he's teaching. And there's a demonic disturbance. There's some guy with, he's plagued with demons. And he causes a disturbance in the thing. And he engages and the demons speak. So Mark 1:24, the demons say to Jesus, have you come to destroy us? If you go to Exodus chapter, you can find it in chapter 2, different places. Exodus 2:14, listen to this. Who made you prince and judge over us? Do you mean to kill us? It's interesting. So there's parallel thoughts. And I up until now, I probably wouldn't get too terribly excited. Just interesting. But the next thing that I read, I went ahead and woke up Dahlia in the middle of the night. It was like 2 a.m. You can't see this. You can't believe this. You know, she was
impressed.
Yeah, she was very. There's a lot of love, and she said, "Oh, that's great. Let's think about that some more in the morning." Mark 1, verse 24. When the people see this event and they see what Jesus has done, they basically say, what is it? Or what is this?
Oh, it's verse 27.
Verse 27. Mm-hmm. Yes. What is it? So, in In Greek, it looks like this. Ti estin tuto, which is, you know, three very common Greek words. There's nothing to get too excited about. They're just three very common. If you did a Bible search, you know, on those, you'd get thousands of references. But in that particular order, ti estin tuto, only once in the whole Septuagint, in that order. And that is in Exodus. So the manna, manhu, is ti estin tuto. So if you want the reference, that's Exodus 16, verse 15. And it only shows up in Mark one time, those three words in that order. It does show up in the Gospel of John twice, those three words in that order. And I wasn't quite sure what to do with that. I looked at it quite a bit. Thought Randy Booth was going to be here this morning. I might jog him on that a little. But it's a potential parallel, because what Jesus is doing is different. It's new. It's like manna.
And he's the bread.
And yeah.
And he's the what?
The bread of life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So Luke, the only parallel Luke has, in Luke 4:34, he says, "Have you come to destroy us?" Okay, that's what the demon said. And then in Luke 4:36, instead of ti estin tuto, Luke says, "What is this word?" So it's a different, it's a slightly different response. So basically, I have Mark and I have Exodus with that particular thing. So, yeah, I got quite excited. That's an interesting parallel. I think we're supposed to notice things like that. Whether it was intentional or not, it certainly, you know, it woke me up. So I kept looking. I went for several days. I was calling David Biffin at strange hours, and David thought it was, oh, that sounds good, you know. So then, boy, that was fuel to the furnace, and everybody else thought it sounded pretty good. So I kept going, and that's probably when it got a little crazy. So I don't want to give you all my craziness, but I started seeing things like, only in Mark, I started seeing things like, you know, when people would bring the sick to Jesus, the whole city would be gathered at the door and many sick were healed and so forth. You know, none of the other Gospels mention that they gathered at any door, but in the book of Exodus, doorways are really important. And, you know, protection, healing, you know, protection against the angel of death. So I started even thinking, even every time Mark mentions healing at a door, I'm thinking, I wonder if he's reminding us, you know, that everything Jesus does is something that we're supposed to notice that Moses also did. Because the Jewish people, for the most part, are waiting for Messiah to be like Moses, right? So maybe these little hints are something, but I don't want to go down too many bunny trails, especially if my sister's here and she's filming. Not only is this being recorded, it's being filmed, so like body language will be analyzed later on. Mark chapter 1, verse 35 through 38. And this is also kind of a bunny. This is a stretch. This is thin ice. But I just think it's interesting. In the morning, or pros, you could even say early in the morning, he rose and went out to a lonely place, or if you're accurate with your Greek, it should be eremos, wilderness. We don't really have deserts up in the Galilee, but we do have wilderness. Wilderness of Bethesda is actually a reference in Luke for that. So he rose up and went to a wilderness place. His disciples pursued him and said, Everyone is searching for you. In verse 38, he said to them, let us go on to the next towns. And I just thought that's just an odd comment. And Luke is the only other reference for something similar where he says, I must preach the good news of the kingdom of God to other cities also, for I was sent for this purpose. So it does weigh in with Luke. But if you look at the book of Exodus, chapter 8, verse 20, we have the Lord speaking to Moses, basically even telling him to get up early in the morning and confront Pharaoh as he goes down to the water and say to him, this is what the Lord says, let my people go so that they may worship me. So I have these interesting parallels. I've got this early morning thing and I've got Jesus saying, let us go. I was compelled to see a connection. Now that might just be a little bit ridiculous, but let's just keep going. And you can draw your own conclusions at the end if I'm guilty of parallelism.
It's 8:16, 8:20.
Well, you might be right.
No, 20 is rise early.
Yeah, rise early in verse 20.
Verse 20.
Well,
I've
Jewish.
Oh,
yeah, in Hebrew it's 16,
yes, you're right. Okay. All right. Let's move on down. Let's go to Mark 2, verse 12. After healing the paralytic, the people glorified God, saying, we never saw anything like this. And in Exodus 10, for example, verse 6, the plague of locusts to the Egyptians, something neither your fathers nor forefathers have ever seen. Okay. And you don't have any other parallels in Luke or Matthew. Luke does at one point say, we have seen strange things today. So that could be. Okay, here's an interesting one. I was actually hoping Randy would be here for this.
But that's a sorry, I mean, that's a point too, like, that we oftentimes forget, like, that in English, that in Hebrew and in those days, just simple words make connections for people. When you use just a phrase or a couple words, phrases like that, people do make those connections.
Oh, yeah.
So if it sounds spurious to us that would be a connection, it's not for people in that culture. You use two phrases like that that are the same words in two verses. For people in that culture, that's an instant click, and especially for people who know the entire Bible or at least whole passages of popular passages by heart, then it's not far-fetched.
Yeah. So if I had a sentence and I says I love to eat lechem, you know, especially certain times of the year when I'm feeling afflicted.
See, that would make an even stronger case for your one about the manna.
Oh, I definitely.
Because that's a very popular, and so that would have just immediately shocked them back to there.
I think so. And I know the original conversation wasn't in Greek. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that, you know, sort of kills us, because we know so much of these conversations were in Hebrew. We can only hope to reconstruct a little bit of this.
But we know so few verses today by heart. Like, the only way you could, like, do an example of that is like saying, "For Yoni so loved the world with all his heart," that, you know, something like that. Where
for the world was so Oni.
Right.
Now, did Bob Lindsay translate that way in his Hebrew, Mark?
You know what? I never thought to look there for that. That's a good point. Bob Lindsay did translate the Gospel of Mark back into Hebrew, and he went from the Greek, and he pushed it back into Hebrew. And I have that on my shelf, but I never thought to look at his rendering of Mark 1, 27. I'm going to have to do it now. I've had 20 years to think about it. Why haven't I done more? Here's an interesting one. And I'm not quite sure what to make of all this, so I'll let you chew on this as well. This is Mark 3, 5, and 6. And it's... you have Jesus becoming angry and grieves at the hardness of heart. And among the people, and which includes Pharisees and Herodians. Pharisees and Herodians. We don't have the foggiest idea who the Herodians were. Sounds like we know, but we don't have any other references. Nowhere else in the New Testament. Josephus never calls any group Herodians, and he would be our main springboard for some. He never mentions a group of people called Herodians. So you'll look at commentaries, Bible commentaries. We nobody really knows what to do with it, but we think it's probably officials in Jerusalem and royal family attachments to the Herodian clans, but we don't really. Mark's the only one that uses that term, and it's just, wow, okay, there it is. Don't know what to do with it. But I look at a few places in Exodus 11, verse 8. This might be the first time that Moses became angry about something. So Exodus 11, 8. And then Exodus 8:33. I think this is the first time that Pharaoh hardens his heart. You all know about that. And then in Exodus 10, verse 1. Exodus 11, 8, 8:33.
32.
Or 32. Yeah, it could be 32.
There's no 33.
Yeah, it's 32. That, see, I'm also looking at...
the Hebrew.
No, I'm also looking at Septuagint. So
yeah, I know that.
There's certain verses are much longer in the Septuagint. Anyway, and Exodus 10, 1. And in Exodus 10, 1, I have... God hardens the hearts of Pharaoh and his officials, right? And, you know, I don't have any reference like this in Luke or Matthew. Matthew never talks about Jesus becoming angry at the hardness of people's hearts. And of course, there's no Pharisees and Herodians in any other. So I've got a potential parallel in Mark with several thoughts in Exodus. Who are the Herodians? I don't know. But it sounds like Pharaoh and his officials. It sounds like the same kind of language. So I'm not trying to make a big deal out of who the Herodians are. Mark may have known some people. But for him, they're held in the same kind of light as Pharaoh and his officials. Okay. Now, let's... I hope you're not... lost in this. There's quite a few times in Mark's gospel where we find Jesus hemmed in by the Sea of Galilee. And there will be crowds and they'll press in on against him. The first reference, I think, is Mark 3, 7 through 10. But several other times in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 6, I know of.
Luke
also Mark 4. There's several places where I can think of in my head where Jesus is kind of pressed by crowds and he's got the sea behind him. Let me just give you something I wrote on this. Here. These are more accurate numbers because this is just using an English translation. Jesus is under pressure from the crowds. Mark 3, 9 through 10. He doesn't have time. Sometimes he's so under pressure on this shoreline that at one point he doesn't even have time to eat a meal of bread. This is Mark 3:20. What does that remind you of? A lot of pressure. There's really no time to eat a proper meal with bread with leaven in it. And so similar. So that's Mark 3:20. And I would also say here, this may mean something. Mark never ever calls the Sea of Galilee a lake, and it's definitely a lake. It's a wide spot in the Jordan River. It's fresh water. It's a lake. It's not a thalassa. It's not a sea. Although we've got Matthew twice calls it thalassa, and Mark always calls it thalassa. Luke always calls it limnane, lake. All right, so you kind of go, well, Mark surely knew it was just a lake. Why does he always call it a sea? And after I'm looking at all these verses in the first 9 chapters of Mark about the Sea of Galilee and the pressure and stuff, I realize he's calling it a sea on purpose. It's to remind us of Moses, the children of Israel. They were also under a pressure. And so it's like the Reed Sea. It's like... Anyway, so it seems strange.
It's always saltwater.
Yeah, yeah, always. Always. You don't have a... why don't we call the Great Salt Lake a sea? I've always wondered. But otherwise, a lake is fresh water, a sea is salt water.
I thought it was the translation from Yam.
Well, Yam can be a big body of water, a smaller body. That doesn't really help us.
That's what I mean. So then you can translate it either.
You could. If all this is originally in Hebrew, then when it goes into Greek...
It's according to interpretation.
It's according to interpretation or context or... Mm-hmm. And you might have a lot of liberty at that point. So I don't want to go too far with this because I don't know how this stuff looked in its original form. And we lost Matthew's gospel at Caesarea probably in the 1st or 2nd century anyway. Because nothing's going to survive that salty environment. But I think it's interesting. Mark is very consistent, calls it a thalassa. Luke, always a lake. Limnane.
And you think whoever was translating it would be referring to something.
Yeah. And these things can be, I can imagine, you know, you've got scribes, you're orally transmitting some things, and maybe it's going out. I don't want to go too far. But I just think it's very fun. Let's get on into some nitty-gritty stuff. Mark 4:35. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." A great storm of wind and waves arose. The waves beat into the boat. I'm sort of paraphrasing here. But he was in the stern asleep, and they woke him, his disciples woke him. And when he was awake, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Right? Is that verse 39?
Mm-hmm.
Tsiopa in Greek. And he said to them, "Why are you still afraid? Have you no faith?" Well, I have a parallel in Exodus, and this is a pretty obvious one. So we go to Exodus I'll throw one verse here. Exodus 13, verse 20. Israel camps for the night in the evening, and they see the armies of Egypt approaching, and they're terrified. So that kind of reminds me of Mark 4, 35. And then I move into Exodus 14, starting in verse 15. Where God tells Moses, tell the Israelites to move on, cross over to the other side of the Red Sea before the waters are parted. Throughout the night, God protected Israel from the Egyptians with a strong east wind. The Lord drove back the sea. So we've got wind in both stories. We've got tension. We've got darkness. We've got pressure against the shoreline. We've got fear. And then in verse 14, the Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. Now, it's not Siopa. It's from the word siago, which both words basically mean the same thing in Greek. So there really isn't any difference. It's just not the same word. I was kind of thinking it would be. In Hebrew, tacharishon, quiet be still, peace be still. And then Moses tells the people, do not be afraid. So we've got two stories that are really similar. A storm in Mark, nighttime, fearful disciples thinking they're all going to drown. And then Jesus says, peace be still. And Moses basically says the same thing. We don't have this story. We don't have this detail in Luke or Matthew. We've got the storm. And Matthew even says it's evening when they set sail. And we've got disciples who are afraid, but we don't hear Jesus saying those three, peace be still. So it's really interesting. So only Mark and only Exodus. So now I feel like we're on a roll. It's more than just T.S. in tutto and maybe some happenstance parallels. I think it's really, Mark knows this story and he knows it really well, and he arranges it so that it kind of flows with the Exodus pattern. Got details in there that nobody else has. And as you can imagine, the very next thing in sequence that happens in Mark, they come to the other side, Mark 5, verse 1, the area of the Gerasenes. Mark and Luke seem to have the same detail, so I'm going to stick with Mark and Luke. Matthew's story is very different. He's got two demoniacs. He's got kind of a different area, so I don't know what to do with that. So I'm just going to stick with Mark and Luke here and Exodus. So Mark 5:1, this man possessed with an unclean spirit comes out of the tombs to meet Jesus. They have a little dialogue. And the unclean spirits went into the pigs, a herd of about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea, and they drown. And those who had seen what had happened, verse 16, verse 17, they began to beg Jesus to depart their region. All right. If you flip over to Exodus 14, during the last watch of the night, verse 24, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. Skip down to verse 27. At daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing towards it, and the Lord swept into the sea. No one survived. So it's just like the pigs. We got Pharaoh's army, a legion, if you want to use the military, that's kind of fun. And pigs and the legion both drown. The people, the Egyptians, if you remember back in chapter 12, verse 33, after some of these plagues, they're telling Israel to please leave their region. So we've got interesting parallels here. Very strong. I think they're very strong parallels. Really beautiful. To me, they're very inspiring. I get very excited with this. It's probably because I've had courses on Midrash and hermeneutics, and we're supposed to see things like this. And so I feel like I'm using the tools that I've gleaned. I'm going to give you one or two more, and then I probably need to go downstairs. Mark, let's see. Mark 6, verses 1 through 6, which is a little bit different than Luke's version in chapter 4. This is when Jesus goes up to Nazareth, and he reads in the synagogue, and there's this scene where, especially in Mark, that people really get, they get interested in this. Okay, so verse 2, many who heard him were astonished, saying, where did this man get all this? What is the wisdom given to him? What powerful works or wonders are brought forth from his hands? If you look at Exodus chapter 4, verse 21. And the Lord said to Moses, when you go back into Egypt, you know, like to your hometown, so to speak, see that you do before Pharaoh all of the wonders which I have put in your hands. And I don't have any parallel in Luke or Matthew for this, if you want to check this further. And then he says, but I will harden his heart and he will not let the people go. If you look at Mark 6 verse 5, it says he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. It's interesting. He goes back to, and there's a second time, another time in Nazareth where it's kind of negative. It's his hometown. It's Mark maybe saying to us, you know, hey, look, it's happening to Jesus too. Nazareth symbolically is like going back to Goshen or something. I'm going to leave you with this one. This one is perhaps the hardest one. It's not the last one. Like for me, the last one would be the Transfiguration account. Between Mark and Exodus, there's a lot of parallels in the Transfiguration. Like Mark, for example, the Transfiguration, you have a cloud, you have a voice that comes from the cloud. Jesus is transfigured in Sinai. Moses is transfigured. He's got this brightness. People can't even look at him. There's been a cloud. There's been a voice. You know, so there's these parallel stories. It's also in Luke and Matthew. But in Mark, there's a couple very specific things. One of them is that 6 days, Jesus took three people up this mountain. And in the book of Exodus, we also have Moses, he took up 70 a certain distance, and then he took three people up a little further, but he was actually told to wait 6 days prior to that. So it's interesting there. We've got this 6 day thing. And then Matthew also follows Mark on that point. Luke says it's about 8 days later. You know, it's kind of random. But I think these parallels kind of crescendo at the Transfiguration and also Mount Sinai. There's a lot of interesting parallels. But before we get there, this is the last one I want to deal with this morning. And this is the hardest one to explain. And in fact, you're not going to agree with my conclusion. Okay? You'll disagree. And we will have friendship. We'll go out and have ice cream later and coffee, and we'll all be friends. This is Mark chapter 6. Jesus calls his 12 disciples together and sends them out two by two. And you have the same parallel in Luke 9 or Matthew 10, that Jesus sends out the 12 to preach, you know. And in Mark 6, verse 8, he charged them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but that they should be wearing sandals. Sandals on their feet. If you look at these parallel passages, we have a problem. We have a problem between these three synoptic gospels, because I have both. I have Luke saying, do not take a staff. And I have Matthew saying, do not take a staff or sandals. What do I do with that? Our scholarly community would weigh in and talk about this. We'll try to reconcile this. But immediately, I know the passage in Exodus. I know in Exodus 12 that the Hebrew people, the Israelites, were commanded to eat the Passover with their loins girded, because they're about to go out. They're about to be sent out. They're supposed to have their sandals on their feet and their staff in their hands. So, what do I do with this? For me, I was really thrilled when I saw this. I got very excited because I thought, Mark is a preaching tool. This is in Jewish culture 2,000 years ago, and even still today, this midrash can include word plays and all kinds of things, and sermonizing, and it makes us kind of uncomfortable even to say it that way. But he's got a story about Jesus. Does Mark switch the details? Or are these details the correct ones and Luke and Matthew switch the details? Or are they just two separate different stories? And that's where most scholars go, they're just different accounts that Luke and Matthew are talking about. Mark's account is something else. Because he's got the little detail. It comes about 2x2. And Luke and Matthew don't say 2x2. So it must be two different stories. But for me, I look at that and I think, whatever Mark's source material was, firsthand or source material, if it's Q, I don't really care. Care should start with Q. I don't know if Mark has a copy of Luke in front of him, which is sort of the Bob Lindsay school, that Mark takes Luke and goes, it needs to happen this way, it needs to be presented in a slightly different way, and Mark borrows from Luke all over the place. And Randy Booth is not here, but Randy would even tell you that Bob Lindsay discovered these Mark and pickups, like he's borrowing from Acts, but he's not doing the full quote, he's only doing partial, so he's definitely borrowing from Luke. Luke had the longer and Mark shortened it and borrowed a few words, Mark and pickups. So that Mark had Luke and Acts in front of him when he composed his gospel. That's Bob Lindsay's conclusion. And I was heavily influenced by that. And the whole Jerusalem School Synoptic Gospel Research, the whole approach is based on, either Luke or Q or some kind of source material that Luke had and Mark had, type of thing. Does Mark change the details? It would be very likely, understanding how things worked 2,000 years ago in Jewish circles, preaching, teaching, midrash. It's not out of the ordinary to switch a detail like that to throw you towards some key scripture, to inspire you to say, look at there. It really is a second Moses. He really is the Messiah. And, yeah.
And what was the Exodus passage you were...
Exodus 12. verse 11, but again, it might be the Septuagint.
No, that's the English.
So, in conclusion, I think we're supposed to notice some of these parallels, and I think we are supposed to get very excited about them and preach them. And it's up to somebody else to sort out, sandals or not. I'm not going to be the guy to sort that out. but I'm going to be inspired by it either way. And if you only preach from Luke, the kingdom of heaven will still spread. If you only preach from Mark and Exodus, we expect spreading, except without leaven today.
That's all.
Yeah, now we go for ice cream.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, that one.
I find that one stronger than all the other ones in here.
The what?
I find that one stronger, except for the mana one. I like that.
Oh, I love the mana one, but that's actually kind of weak textually, because there's two other times in John's Gospel and they don't quite apply the same way. So, even Randy kind of went, I'm not so sure that you've got a really strong.
Who is this Bob Linzinger?
Yeah.
He was a pastor here for years and years back in the late 40s, 50s, and somewhere in the early 60s, the Southern Baptist commissioned him to translate Mark's gospel into a modern Hebrew because one did not exist. Okay.
We talked about that. I wanted to pull up the thing I shot when we did that.
Is this still?